experienced a trial or a temptation? This is going to be a... Either you're in the middle of it right now, or this will not be as relevant as I thought. Let's try again. How many of you ever have experienced a trial? Okay, all right. You act like you were embarrassed to admit that fact of human existence that we've all been through. And how many of you have always known the difference between which of those two things that experience was?
Not until last week.
We started out last week to try to show that this is an experience that happens just because we're human beings living in the world. All of us go through trials. That doesn't mean God's unhappy with us or that somehow we have failed or that we've been forgotten. It's just life. And then the other thing is that all of us also go through temptations. That this is something that God may in His providence choose to allow us to experience. That this is something that God does not cause. It occurs because we're human beings whose own selfish desires sometimes entice us and appeal to us. And that's something that we have to deal with because we're human beings. Now, we started out to say that these experiences do not mean that our hope to be God's children and to live faithfully is defeated. I mean, we can live for the Lord. And that there are some things that will help us regardless of which of these experiences we're in the middle of. We view the experience as an opportunity to grow. Chapter James 1, verses 2 and 3. We can mature through this. We ask God for wisdom, and He's glad to give it. And just for those of you who are making notes, I added a number 3 here that we didn't have last week. A part of this, in verses 4 and following, that mentions, you know, ask in faith, nothing doubting. A double-minded man is unstable, and he's not going to receive anything. So be single-minded, and then depend on what lasts. Don't think that your money or your possessions or what you got for Christmas will save you, will rescue you in the middle of trials. And there are things that happen where we are jarred to the reality. It doesn't make any difference what kind of car you drive or what kind of house you live in. And all that, what kind of clothing you wear, whatever. Verses 9 through 11, I really am impressed with the last phrase of verse 11, after it's talked about the flower being scorched and withering. When does it say the rich man fades? In the midst of his pursuits. What does that tell you? If you're living with a sense of values which all of a sudden, right when you're in the middle of them, can completely fade away, then you're living for the wrong things, right? And that's the thought. Now, I want to round this out with this one last part of this paragraph, and this is one point that has 2 or 3 implications to it, but in surviving here, keep a healthy view of God, a healthy sense of God, and who God is, what God's motives and purposes are, and what we may expect of Him. And I'd like you to notice that this is a theme through this whole paragraph, this whole chapter here. Notice in verse 5 that James is careful to point out that God gives generously to anyone who will ask Him, and He gives without reproach. Notice in verses 9 to notice verse 7 that He gives with a view toward what's good for people. It's not good for people to think that they can use God like an insurance policy. He gives to the humble. And now we begin at verse 12. And what we're going to do is to look from verses 12 through 18, and then we're going to go back through this section by looking at some of the motivations here. And that's a part of this passage that's overlooked sometimes. Start in verse 12. Tim, would you read for us 12 through 15?
Blessed is a man who perseveres under trial. For once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted. For God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. Then when lust was conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death.
All right, now let's think about this for a second. We'll look at 16 and 18 in just a moment. But what key point about God comes up first in verse 12? All right, somebody whispered it, say it out loud. All right, God has promised. All right, he has promised something to those who love him. By the way, to those who love him is an important phrase in James. It comes up again in chapter 2 and verse 5. What can you tell me about God and his promises? What motivates God making promises? Does he do it because we deserve to have promises made to us, that we've earned it? All right. The word promise means that it's motivated by his own goodness and his own graciousness. All right. Now, what do you know about God's character as relates to his promises? All right. He has always kept them, and there are two reasons he always keeps his promises.
God cannot lie.
All right. First one, he is faithful. God, it's not possible for him to lie because he had truth as a part of his nature. So that's the first thing. What's the other thing that ensures that God always keeps his promises?
He says.
All right, he says it. That goes with his faithfulness. I'm going to chalk that one up to his faithfulness.
History.
All right, demonstrates this point. Let me give you another clue. I can imitate God's faithfulness and try to always be true to my promises. But that highlights my limitations on the other thing that ensures that God will keep his promise.
He is able.
He's able. All right. His power. His faithfulness and his power. God is truthful and he is able to keep his promises. And those two things are always borne out with Abraham and Sarah and the gift of Isaac, if you remember Romans 4 and Hebrews 11 in the New Testament. All right, that's the first thing about God. Now, what can happen in the middle of temptation when we're thinking about God and his promises? When a person is really feeling the pressure of temptation,
why is God allowing this?
All right, we will ask, why is God allowing this? And
some people
will
even ask, why is God doing this? Why me, Lord?
All right, why me? Why is God doing this? It implies that God is doing this. Go all the way back to Genesis 3 for a moment. And remember the subtle suggestion of the tempter. What the not so subtle part of it was? Remember, hath God said. What was he doing? He was creating doubt about what God had promised, wasn't he? Oh, yeah, are you sure? And implied in that, are you sure, is why would he say this? In fact, the tempter went ahead to say, he just knows that if you eat the fruit of this tree, you'll be like him. You know, that's the idea. Now, observe in what James says here, that James, as a practical matter, is afraid that believers in the Lord will get to the place where, notice he says when he is tempted, not if tempted. James knows that God's children are going to be tempted. All right? And James is afraid that we'll say, I'm being tempted by God. Now, when you think you're being tempted by God, what do you think of him? Well, somebody said, why is he doing this to me? No. All right, you lose respect for him. You think that if he'll do this for me, I can't trust his promises. So how does James answer that fear? All right, God neither cannot be tempted, he neither can be tempted, nor does he tempt.
Does he test?
I would say that the Bible teaches he allows tests to occur. He certainly tested Abraham, didn't he?
Yes.
He did. He cannot be tempted, and therefore he does not tempt. And notice what quality of character is there that would be such that God cannot be tempted? That same quality of character means that he won't tempt. What is it?
Is it because he's holy?
All right, I think it is because he's holy. All right, he's not affected by evil. And what word would we use to say that? We've mentioned his faithfulness and his power or ability, and now we're talking about his goodness as a part of his holy nature. His holiness is all of his attributes together, but his goodness means that God first can't be tempted. Evil holds no appeal to him. And he certainly won't appeal to people to be the opposite of what he himself is. So God cannot be tempted, nor does he tempt, which means that I have to, in view of my being tempted, I have to be realistic about what's going on. And what does James say is going on when a person is tempted?
He's being carried away by someone.
All right. He is being carried away. Gets translated sometimes lured.
Drawn.
Or enticed. And what kind of picture does that paint in your mind? Like my brothers fancy themselves fishermen. One of them told me one time, he cast out there with his single spin. He said, I can just see that fish down there with his mouth open. And he said, my job is to just move this just right at the right speed where he just can't stand it and he'll have to strike it.
That's why it's called a lure.
That's why it's called a lure. Okay. I've learned something today already. Think about that now.
And there's a desire to be drawn away.
All right. There is when I'm being tempted, what I have to look at is what is there in me that makes this, it makes me consider this a possibility. To be tempted, you have to consider something a possibility. That has to be a thought that you dwell on first. Of course, this implies a tempter also that we'll talk about over in chapter 4 of this book. But look at the genealogy of sin that's painted here, the autobiography of sin that's painted in verse 14 and 15. What is the order of things? First, there is the person's own lust. That is an evil desire, or a desire that depends on evil for its fulfillment, that I then stop and look at, consider.
Three lusts
are, tell us.
Lust of the eyes, the flesh, and pride of life.
That's right. 1 John 2, and those are the three possible avenues that these things can come with. So I stop and consider it, And then this desire is painted like a pregnancy that we're not comparing pregnancy to evil, certainly, but the conception, the lust that conceives the possibility and brings forth the act, gives birth to sin, and then when sin may occur, and it may seem like nothing happened right then. There were no consequences. But you go along and remember with the case of the first sin, this is an instructive situation. First thing is the sin occurs, it looks like nothing happens. But then they hear the voice of God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And what happens?
Hide.
They hide. There's the fear and the alienation, the guilt that goes along. And then that finally, that's separation is called death. All right. Now, that gives us maybe a way to think about God. God has made promises. He won't tempt me, so when I am tempted, I have to stop and think about the source of that and whether there's something I can do to correct it or need to do to protect myself in God's care. Now look at verses 16 through 18. Randy, would you read, please?
Do not be deceived, my beloved brother. Every good thing bestowed and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shift in shadow. In the exercise of his will, he brought us forth by the word of truth, so that we might be, as it were, the first fruits among his creatures.
All right, now think about that. What is he thinking in verse 16 when he says, don't be deceived? In this context, what kind of deception is he thinking about? I think most of the versions will attach 16 to 17. So if that helps to think about it. Is it just being deceived in general that he's worried about, or is there some particular point that he thinks we might be misled about when we're in the middle of a trial or a temptation?
I think it's like Eve. She was deceived. She got off bound to what God said.
All right.
Listen to what somebody else said.
And she got to thinking that God didn't have her best interest in mind. And so the lust of the eyes brought forth the lust of the flesh because the tempter had appealed to the pride of life.
She could become God.
She could become God, and that's what happened. And in this case here, he wants us not to begin to accredit evil and the problems to God to the point that we forget that He is the giver. So the point made here is that God is the giver of every good and perfect gift. And it's a way of saying that when you're in the middle of a trial or a temptation, it helps to consciously look for the good gift and to count your blessing, right? Count your blessings. That seems like a simple thing, but look at the Father of lights. There is a constancy about God that is helpful when you're in the middle of temptation. Why, when you're in the middle of a trial or a temptation, does it help to remember that with the Father of lights, there's no shadow cast by change or variation? There's no shadow cast by turning. Why does that help in the middle of the trial or the temptation?
It shows that God is steadfast.
All right.
He doesn't change.
There is somebody you can count on. Isn't that what happens when you're in trial or temptation? You start thinking about, in this little world, there's not one thing you can count on. Well, there is somebody whose character is such that he doesn't change and he can be relied upon. And then verse 18 shows that of God's own will, I'm running out of space here, so I'm not going to write this. Now, it's not because it's less important, but of his own will, he's already brought us forth by the word of truth. You know that he wouldn't go to the trouble to bring us forth to be his children and then forget us or neglect us. So the point he's doing and he's helping at least helps us to keep a healthy view of God in the middle of the trying times in our lives. All right. How can we overcome? One of those things will help in the middle of a trial or temptation, maybe more than one. Can you think back in your life, or maybe think of your life right now, of some trial or temptation that you have experienced, and think of where one of those things helped you? I'm not asking for a raise of the hands and a description of the experience, but can you?
Well, if you depend on what lasts, you've got a hope for eternity.
All right.
You don't have to worry about what happens.
All right. It doesn't, it makes us, what we said last time, in 100 years, it won't make any difference. It helps us keep our perspective. That's right. One of these things will help. Now, In the last few minutes in our class this morning, I want to turn our attention to the other part of this. And do you realize that a lot of the time when we're in the middle of a trial or temptation, this part of it is more than half of the battle? Do you recognize why? Why is that?
Don't give up.
All right, if you're convinced of a reason to overcome this, or why it's worth it, or why you should, then that's half the battle in knowing that you can, isn't it? And you can think of all kinds of illustrations of that point in life, but that's half the battle. And what I would like to ask is, what happens when we go back through James chapter 1 and focus on the reasons James gave for the various actions that he asked his readers to take? I think that's an interesting exploration. So let's try it. Let's go back to verses 2 through 4 and ask, what are the reasons for overcoming the trials and the temptations that come along? What's the first reason that you see? And I'll try to first focus on one in each of these little paragraphs. But why, the first thing that he had to say, what's the reason attached to it, the motivation attached to it?
Produces patience.
All right, it produces patience. If I meet a trial, and if I endure that trial with joy, it produces a steadfastness or a patience that finally, look at the end of verse 4. When steadfastness or patience has its full effect, what does it do?
Perfectly complete.
All right, and what would be another word that we call that?
Maturity.
Maturity. All right. This then leads to, I'm going to use two words with it, since it talked about being perfect and complete. I would say that this experience leads to maturity and strength. Alright, think of what it takes to get you in cardiovascular or physical condition, good shape. What does it take, unfortunately? It takes what's called reps.
Intestinal.
All right, it does take that. In other words, it takes the endurance of something physically in order to do that. You can tell lifting this marker wears me out. But you see what we're saying. Now, unfortunately, if I ask God for wisdom, Now just think about this. What did we say wisdom is? All right, it's not knowledge, but it is knowing how to use your knowledge to tell the difference between what's good and what is not good. All right, if I ask God for wisdom, since wisdom is not knowledge, I mean, I could ask him for knowledge and he could send me to school. And I have a good teacher, comfortable room and all that. But how is he going to give me wisdom?
You've got to put that knowledge to use.
All right, now.
You have to be tested.
All right, say it loud, more loud, Jen.
You have to be tested.
You have to be tested so God may give me wisdom by allowing me to pass through a trial. So here I am in the middle of a trial needing wisdom. And I ask God for wisdom, and what does he do?
Gives you fire.
he goes with me through the trial, you see. The wisdom, it means that not that God removes the trial, but that he promises to go through it with you and to give you the understanding heart that you need through that experience. Right, Brother Finney?
But Jesus also said, he would not give you a serpent, and not give you something bad.
That's right. I'm not saying that he'll make it worse. I'm saying that he goes with you through it and gives you the ability to endure. In other words, James is calling for endurance, and he's promising that God will make that possible, and that having passed through it, you will be not in a worse condition, but a better person because of it. Have you ever noticed how many people there are who go through really tough circumstances in life at one point or another? And if you look back on their biography and see the stuff they've been through, it often amazes you what they've endured. But if you talk to those people, have you ever noticed how many of them will say, even if I could go back, I wouldn't change any of it. Now, a lot of people will. I'm not overlooking that. But how many people will say, I wouldn't change any of that? And I think that this has to be one of the explanations of that right here. All right, now, verses 5 and following, what motivation is there attached to this here? What will it told me what to do in this passage as far as asking for wisdom and being single-minded, but what motivation is given? And I think I'll give you a hint. I think it appears in verse 5, and also it's implied in verse 7. All right. It is that God will provide. Where did that phrase first come from?
Abraham.
And what caused Abraham to say that?
He's going to sacrifice his son.
All right. When Isaac said, look here, Father, we have the wood and we have the fire, but we're missing something. What are we going to sacrifice? And Abraham said,
God will provide.
That's exactly right. And God did provide, and that's the idea here. Look with me now down at verse 9 through 11. What reason, what motivation for overcoming is there here? This is a principle that James returns to later on, by the way. I think it's stated or implied in verse 9.
Riches will pass away.
All right, riches will pass away, but also All right. God exalts the humble. The humble will be exalted. that is exactly the way that James returns to this in James 4. that when you see that you can't do this by yourself, you're in a condition where God can help. The humble, the person who's not consumed with himself, is the one that God can, through his grace, exalt. And James is going to say that God gives grace to the humble, but that he opposes the proud, if you remember. And that's the idea that comes up here. All right, now, verse 12 brings up the next reason, or next motivation to overcome. We didn't dwell on this a while ago, but what is it? All right. And the crown of life. John is not the only writer that brings up this idea of the crown. John uses the idea in the Revelation, certainly. Paul talks about the crown of righteousness. That hope, under what circumstances was a crown given in the world in which James lived? An athlete who had endured the contest was given the laurel wreath, the victor's crown. There's a whole study that goes on about a ruler's crown or a victor's crown and all of that kind of thing. But this is a crown, and what is the crown? Not laurel leaf, but all right, the crown is life. That's the idea here that there is. So what would be the worst thing that could happen to you in the middle of a trial? You could die. All right. Would that then defeat you forever?
Maybe. Maybe not.
All right. It could if you were not passing or standing the test that it talks about here. But if you stand the test, then the crown of life is a reason to hold on. Okay, Ruth?
Well, I'm kind of thinking the worst thing that could happen in the middle of the trial is you give up on God.
That is the worst thing that could happen. But in verse 12, notice, for when he has stood the test. So this is the assumption here is this person has not and will not give up on God. He stands the test. And if he does, then he receives the crown of life, which Paul says, the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me at that day, the crown of righteousness. All right, now, skip on down with me for a moment. And I think that there is if you want to think of it as a negative motivation, that's appropriate, I think, in verses 14 through 15, or 13 through 15, that when you talk about enduring these trials, it is appropriate to ask about the alternatives. When you're at the end of your rope, what motivation is there to hold on?
Desperation.
All right. Have you guys ever seen the picture of somebody send out with the bug and the frog? Somebody sent me a picture of this old frog that has his tongue has reached out and grabbed a hold of this big old grasshopper or something. And the grasshopper has his two hands around the old frog's neck, just squeezing for all his worth, and his tongue is still sticking out. And that's sometimes you may feel that way. But the alternative, realistically, giving up on God, as Ruth said, would be even worse than the worst trial. So what he's saying is, hang on to that. And then look with me down at verse 18 and 17 and 18. One of the things that James brings up here is this idea of the first fruits. You have a place in the creation as a Christian. And I'm sorry about my writing here, but the way James says this is a fascinating thing to consider. Paul talks in 1 Corinthians 15 about our being the firstborn or first fruits of the dead. But observe carefully the way James says it here. Of his own will, he begat us, or he brought us forth by the word of truth. In other words, the gospel is the seed that begets new life and causes us to be born not to the death of verse 15, but to life again. But what are we here? We should be a kind of first fruits of what? Of his creation. All right. Now, the idea for this then, if I'm reading this right, is our redemption, our new life, is something that has an impact on all of God's creation in some way in his providence. The crown of life, which we expect, is a life that is the first fruits of, I guess, the figure of heaven that we would call the new heavens and the new earth, as and I think it is a figure of heaven in the book of Revelation. But the idea is that I am a part of something greater than these problems. That a part of what has to happen in a person's life, whether it's in a marriage or whether it's in the middle of some problem, physical or otherwise in life, or whether it's a struggle of faith when doubt is sneaking up on us, the thing that convinces you is that you are a part of something bigger than whatever is going on right at that moment, and that it's worth it to hang in. Okay, Brother Fink?
1 Corinthians 10:13 ought to be read, I think.
And read it for us. You got found.
There hath no temptation taken you such as is common to man, but God is faithful and will not suffer you to be tempted above that which you are able, but will, with the temptation, make the way of escape.
All right, very good, very good. Maybe that's when it says here that God is the giver of every good and every perfect gift, one of the things that we ought to think about is the
way of escape.
Yeah, pray for the way of escape, and that would be one of the gifts that God promises to provide. Y'all have been a patient class. I admire the way you have endured today and appreciate so much your being here with us. Hope everybody has a great week, and I wish you a happy new year, and I'll see you next year, Lord willing.